a.m. This called the meeting to order for the State of Arizona Board of Dietary Examiners, March 12th, 2025. Heather has basically performed roll call already, so we will move on to the Declaration of Conflicts of Interest. If anyone has any conflict for any agenda item, please voice it now. Okay, hearing done, we'll move on. We can go back to our minutes. We're going to start here on our investigation, or subheading 5, which is Items for Board Review, Discussion, and Possible Action. We have investigation files. We will start with number, complaint 2417-C, which is Dr. Robert Novak's case, and Dr. Arthur Callis is the investigator on that case. So we will ask Dr. Callis to give us a summary of his report.
Good morning. I'm just going to do a quick summary of this. The State Board received a complaint from JA on October 3rd, 2024, against Dr. Robert Novak. JA filed a complaint on behalf of her brother, KC, who died on October 7th, 2023, of stage 4 GE junctional cancer with liver metastasis. Our report is 15 pages in length, and it's just a summary of the conclusions and findings. In JA's complaint, she mentioned several doctors. Her complaint was regarding her dissatisfaction of medical care received by her brother. The doctors mentioned in her complaint were 5 doctors and 1 nurse practitioner. The complaint against Dr. Robert Novak was that if her brother would have been diagnosed with the cancer, he may not have gone through multiple debridements of the painful leg ulcers. JA also complained about inadequate number of dressing supplies were given to her brother and that she had to pay for additional dressing supplies. JA also complained that her brother was not given timely referrals. JA also complained that the wounds would have improved with proper treatment. JA also complained that she never received a return phone call from Dr. Robert Novak. She had complained that she had called Dr. Novak's office at minimum 15 times. She did state that she did get a return call twice from Amber Valenzuela, RN. She is a nurse at the Wound Care Center. I did interview the complainant JA on February 5th, 2025, and Dr. Robert Novak on February 5th, 2025. I also reviewed the medical records supplied to the board from Dr. Novak's office. I did find that the medical records were very detailed and complete. The records clearly showed that the standard of care was followed. The records do show that on each visit to have a Havasu Wound Center, KC was seen by 2 different nurses prior to being seen by Dr. Novak. The records also show that discussions between the nurses and Dr. Robert Novak occurred prior to debridement and for wound dressing and cleansing. Dr. Robert Novak did assure me that this is the standard protocol of the Havasu Wound Clinic, where he is employed. KC was also given many referrals to physicians. KC was referred by Dr. Novak to Dr. Fadi Astafi, who is a cardiologist, Dr. Dimitri Hernandez, an internist, Dr. Mandy Pawa, who is a pain management specialist, Dr. Dana Balderon, a plastic surgeon, and Dr. Robert Zabati, a cardiothoracic surgeon. The timeliness of these referrals appeared to be adequate and appropriate. In addition, Dr. Novak also performed in-office transcutaneous oxygen measurements, radiographs, cultures and sensitivities, and biopsies, which appeared timely and adequate. The records also show that KC was prescribed lidocaine, topical cream, 4%, Percocet, gabapentin, Vulvic, and high-protein nutritional shakes. KC was also either given or prescribed iodazole, antibiotic ointment, Plurigel, skin integrity, wound cleansing spray, Santol, adaptive bone dressing, couple of pads, and silvadine cream. KC was also instructed on each office frequency of dressing changes between offices and what to look for between offices as well as bathing instructions. The records and after discussion with Dr. Novak showed that Casey never requested additional dressing supplies at the office visit. In the allegation, J.A. also had a concern about continued debridement, which was not the case. Dr. Novak did not perform aggressive debridement, only wound cleansings and removal of slough from the wounds after being consulted by Dr. Dana Balderrama on June 21, 2023. Dr. Balderrama is a plastic surgeon and the director of the Havasu Wound Clinic. Dr. Dana Balderrama stated that no further debridement was necessary due to the wounds being vascular in origin. Dr. Dana Balderrama also stated that Casey was not a surgical candidate. In discussing this with Dr. Novak, he stated that he continued to see Casey and that he just did not want to give up on him. So he kept the wounds clean by having the wounds cleansed and the slough removed so no infection would occur. Dr. Novak also did refer Casey to a vascular and vein workup at Lakeside Heart and Vascular Clinic, which is run by Dr. Roberto Cervantes, on Casey's first visit. Dr. Robert Novak also did make a pain management referral to Dr. Mandy Powell early in the treatment period. Dr. Novak's notes also indicated that Casey was instructed throughout his treatments that Casey should adhere to high nutritional diet, and Dr. Novak's office via Amber Valenzuela, who is an RN, also prescribed high-protein shakes. Dr. Robert Novak also requested Casey to stop smoking and even offered Casey smoking cessation medication, which Casey refused. Regarding the phone calls and the calls not being returned, it was found out in interviewing Dr. Robert Novak that the normal protocol is that the nurses return calls. He also stated that he was totally unaware that she had called his office and requested up to him. In addition, each visit by Casey, he was asked how he was doing, and never did Casey have a complaint. J.A. did mention in her complaint that her brother passed away on October 7, 2023 of stage 4 VE junctional cancer with metastasis to the liver. J.A. stated that her brother may not have continued debridement if he had known. It is unfortunate that Casey did pass away, but Casey has been treated by many specialists and his diagnosis is not the responsibility of Dr. Robert Novak, nor did Dr. Robert Novak know of this diagnosis. In conclusion, Dr. Robert Novak did exercise appropriate clinical judgment and did provide care that meets the professional standards expected. No faults or deficiencies in Dr. Robert Novak's treatment and care has been identified. Considering these findings, Dr. Robert Novak did exercise appropriate clinical judgment and provided care that meets the professional standards expected in such cases. In my opinion, all alleged allegations by J.A. are not substantiated. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Towles, for that very complete report. I have no questions. Do you have any questions, Dr. Foreman?
No, that was a very complete report. I have no questions.
Thank you. Ms. Broman, do you have any questions?
No questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Johnson-Gray, do you have any questions?
I do not. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We do have the complainant sister, the complainant is on the line. She was offered to make a statement but has declined that offer. And if anyone has any questions for her, we shall take them at this time. So does anyone I do not have any questions. Do any of my other board members have questions? Dr. Foreman?
No questions.
Ms. Johnson-Gray?
None.
Ms. Broman?
None.
Okay, hearing none. I believe we all realize that this is an unfortunate situation. There are, other factors, too, involved here with smoking doesn't allow tissue healing. There were other comorbidities present. So, and obviously I do not feel that Dr. Novak has fallen below any standard of care. And I'm sorry, I should have asked prior to making that comment if Dr. Novak would like to make any remarks or if anybody has questions for Dr. Novak.
I have nothing else to say.
Okay, thank you. But Dr. Foreman, do you have any questions for Dr. Novak?
No, the chart was extremely complete.
Ms. Broman, do you have any questions for Dr. Novak?
The only question that I have, Dr. Novak, is did you check with your front desk? Did the person we're discussing call numerous times and you did not get the message?
No, I never got a phone call from her.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Johnson-Gray, any questions?
J.A. This is J.A. I did call numerous times and request return phone calls from Dr. Novak. Never once.
Excuse me. We want to make sure that we don't have a back.
Yes, I know. Yes, exactly. And we gave the complainant opportunity to make a statement. No one had questions for her. We do have her complaint in the record, and everyone is aware. And if I do recall, Dr. Novak made mention that protocol at the wound clinic is the nurses are the ones who deal with the patient questions or family questions, and certainly if there had been anything the nurses felt that Dr. Novak needed to know, they would have informed him. Does anyone, board members, have questions for Dr. Novak?
This is Board Member Johnson Gray. I do not.
Thank you. So, one last opportunity to ask questions before we move on. Again, like I mentioned prior, I think this is just one of those unfortunate situations that obviously Dr. Novak was not responsible to make a cancer diagnosis and was unaware of that. And once he had received information from Dr. B, plastic surgeon, that there was no ability for to be a good surgical candidate due to vascular status, you know, he didn't do anything more aggressive than keep that wound clean. And we see that there is no evidence that the patient was becoming septic. So I think, you know, again, unfortunate situation, no fall below the standard of care. So I will go ahead and make a motion to dismiss case 24-17-D, saying there are no violations of state statute. Thank you, Dr. Foreman. It's been moved and seconded to dismiss case 24-17-C, finding there are no violations of state statutes. Is there any other discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll take a vote. All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed?
Aye.
Opposed? The motion or the complaint is dismissed. And if there are any questions from the complainant, she may contact Heather Broaddus at the board office. Thank you very much. Thanks, Dr. Callis. All righty. What time is Dr. Karp?
8:30.
Okay. All right. So we're going to move on to case 24-18-C, which is Dr. Suresh Yadupa. We have Dr. Daniel Saunders is the investigator on that case. So we'll go ahead. And we don't have, doctor is not present on the phone call, but he has office personnel that are present. If anyone has questions for them, we can speak with, ask them those questions, but we would now just proceed with Dr. Saunders' report.
Okay. Again, 24-18-C. MS made a complaint regarding being billed as out of network for their visit to Dr. Ubedai in court. They were told initially that they were in network with insurance in the office. Upon scheduling the appointment, and then came to find out later that they were being billed as an out-of-network. In addition to
the
pardon me, there's background noise. Is somebody not keeping their phone on mute? It's kind of
Hi, this is Heather Bredis in the board office. Is Dr. Novak still on the line? If so, the your complaint has been adjudicated. You can hang up the phone.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Sorry.
That's okay. Just resuming here, the first complaint was more or less being billed out of network. There was a secondary complaint or concern that MS got additional x-rays taken during the visit and felt that they were unnecessary or did not need to be done, as they were done the previous day at the urgent care. During the follow-up, there was a response from the office, from the core group staff, that is noted. Additional response was from Dr. Upadha himself, basically saying that the appointment was made in an urgent manner. Staff did receive the insurance card based on a referral from the urgent care as being as one type of Cigna, for which they are part of the Cigna group in general. They believed it to be one type of Cigna based on the referral, and it turned out to be a different, I guess, network for the Cigna group that they were out of network on. In regards to the x-rays being taken, they were done at an urgent care the day before. Because this was done on an urgent matter of the appointment, doctors did not have access to those x-rays and felt it was imperative to evaluate the radiographs, so new ones were done. Doctor did not have honor health privileges, so could not even look at them online as well. I did review all the medical records that were provided. The office notes and the billing were reviewed, known to be in good order. The patient was seen at the urgent care on 5/28, and then the next day, 5/29, in the doctor's office for a toe injury. The exam radiographs were reviewed by the doctors. I reviewed them. Everything is in order. An MRI was ordered, which was subsequently done as the doctor recommended for follow-up care. Records, again, as I mentioned, are complete and well-documented. I think the financials were appropriately billed. To really summarize this, the evaluation and treatment performed by the doctor were well within the standards of care. The billing was billed appropriately to the insurance company. It's consistent with the standard. The patient was seen in an urgent matter. It does not appear that staff had time to go back and forth to find out which exact Cigna department they were part of, as they did accept most Cignas. And it is the patient's responsibility, in my opinion, that it's their agreement with the insurance company. It's up for them to comply with the Cigna rules. It's fairly common in our practice that there are sometimes insurance issues. It's not the provider's responsibility for that. That falls to the private insurance company and their claim. So I don't see any deviation within the standard of care.
I have one question. I don't know. Did you ever see, though, in your practice that somebody who's out of network can still be treated on an emergency basis?
I have. You have to get, and sometimes it's done beforehand.
Right.
You have to get an approval through the insurance company. So in this case, doctor would have had to get an approval from, to say, the Cigna, say, hey, normally for continuity of care, I saw this patient in the hospital or it referred me, I spoke to the ER doctor, I'd like to still take care of this patient, will they provide it? Oftentimes they do, not always.
Yeah.
After fact, I think it's hard.
Yeah. Right, and that would have been the responsibility of the
normally it requires, in my opinion, a call from the patient.
Patient,
hey,
right.
I want to follow up with this guy.
Yeah. And I agree with you. I think, you know, there are so many policies out there. People see Cigna, you know, well, there's a gazillion and one policies, and it is a responsibility of the patient. They contracted with the insurance, and obviously, too, they offered a cash discount payment to this patient, and there had been no response back, and the only time that they did receive a response was when they sent them to collections. But as the chart, the documents indicate, that it's been put on hold. So they still, you know, so it's up to the patient to deal with
it. I think it was pending.
Yeah, maybe so. So it's, you know, it's, again, that's between the insurance and the patient. So does anybody have any other questions for Dr. Saunders? Dr. Foreman?
Nope. No, I don't. This happens all the time.
Yeah.
especially when they want to be seen urgently, because you can't check the insurance with the insurance card.
Ms. Johnson-Gray, do you have any questions?
I do not.
Thank you. Ms. Broman, any questions?
I just have one question. It did say in the response from the doctor that they were unclear why at the time of the check the patient's insurance card was not compared to the information on the chart. That was my first question. The other question is, did they tell the patient? And again, I'm not a physician, so I don't deal with billing and stuff. However, they did not look at the insurance card itself. And this individual was sent from the urgent care to this doctor, and it looks like nobody looked at his insurance card. And if that were the case and I handed my insurance card and they told me I was good to go, that's my first thing, is that they said it was in network because they were looking at the wrong thing. But the other thing is the fact that the, and I'm curious about this, at the urgent care, they did take x-rays. For me, in the past, even in an emergency, I have had the doctor's office that is not associated with the urgent care contact, and I fill out a form, and they get the x-rays almost immediately. So I guess that's the other thing. So he was charged for additional x-rays when a phone call and a fax could have taken care of that. So those were my two comments on this.
Thank you. Well, obviously we don't have Dr. Yuduka here to answer that question about the x-rays, but we could ask.
But we do have people in the office?
Yes, we can. You could, that question, and they're listening in, so I would direct them to answer or discuss your questions and concerns. And that would be...
Is now the time?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
So they heard your question, so, and I believe her name is Tanya, so Tanya could answer that question for you, Ms. Broman.
You bet. Sorry. Yes, this is Tanya from the CORE Institute. So I guess with this regards to the insurance and checking it before against the insurance card, I think the front office staff had a misguided or a misinterpretation of what the system was indicating to them at the time of the patient's visit. As they mentioned, Cigna was loaded into our system and it showed that it was active. So it was a little deceiving to our front office. They should absolutely have done a check of the insurance card to make sure that indeed that information was accurate. And you know, kind of process it accordingly from there. So yes, that check should have been done. But again, the system was also misleading in the fact that it showed that the Cigna, the general Cigna, was active for the patient. And again, they've been educated. This is a great example of why it's important, no matter what the system says, to double check that information, especially for these types of patients. And then in regards to the x-rays and the phone calls, our experience with the x-rays and requesting records is that it's not a fast process. It doesn't typically show up the same day. It'll typically take days for us to be able to get those records. So I think that's the reason why we haven't gone down that path.
Okay. Thank you very much. Ms. Bowman, does that answer your question? Questions?
It does answer the question. I don't necessarily agree with the answer. What I just heard was in the past they at times had a problem where it didn't come right away. I've had the same situation personally, and it came immediately because they knew it was an urgent thing, so they went out of their way to make sure that the doctor's office got what was needed. But it sounds like they didn't even try.
Ms. Brown, it's Dr.
Connor. So did you tell them?
Oh, I'm sorry. You can finish.
Pardon?
Go ahead and finish, and then Dr. Saunders would like to make some comment.
Okay. Did you tell the patient? So at this point in time, with the x-rays and stuff, the patient felt and believed that they were in-network, that it was going to be a $15 copay, and you can have x-rays and MRIs, whatever, and that's all included because they were inpatient. They were in yeah. So it was that they were accepting the insurance. So it's a difference of Cigna versus Cigna Arizona Healthcare Exchange. That's what you don't take, but you do take Cigna.
Correct.
Is this correct?
Okay. Yes, that is correct.
So the patient at the time getting the x-rays and stuff believed that they were in-network because that's what they were told.
Correct.
Okay.
Dr. Saunders.
I'm just going to comment regarding x-rays. Oftentimes, we want to have the x-rays available for us so we can make a judgment. They're seeing a specialist like ourselves, and it's the doctor there that's making the judgment. Quite honestly, urgent cares are wrong most of the time. That's why they're referring to a specialist. And getting an x-ray report via fax does not substitute taking another x-ray and actually looking at it. For them to deliver the x-rays, it's not going to be in a quick manner. It would be probably 2 weeks, and you get a CD that may or may not work. So it's quite common, and it is really the standard of care to take an x-ray to make a judgment whether or not you're going to let that patient walk out of there or not. So I have no problems with them taking another x-ray because it wasn't available. The patient could have asked for a CD right there in the urgent care and then brought the copies of the x-rays with them, and they didn't. And, you know, as far as cost goes, this is not an overutilization problem, taking another x-ray, because the specialist is doing it this way. Oftentimes, weight-bearing in our specialty office as opposed to not in the urgent care. So that should not be an issue regarding this. As far as insurance coverage goes,
Dr. Saunders,
too,
Oh,
go ahead.
Sorry. I understand that it is normal. I personally go someplace where they will not take anybody else's x-rays. I understand that. But I am looking from the side of the patient, hearing they thought that they were in-network because they were told that they were in-network, so x-rays would not have been an issue unless they had to pay for it, which they didn't think that they did because they thought that they were in-network. That is my comment. If the patient knew that they were out-of-network, I think that something different would have been done by the patient, either asking for a different doctor, or they would have said, let me go back and get the x-rays or something. I'm not sure. I have no idea. We do not have the patient on the phone. But that is my only point, is that in-network versus out-of-network and the cost of taking extra x-rays and not knowing all the things that were being done, not knowing that they were going to have to pay for it out of pocket.
Sure. I do think that's the agreement between the patient and the insurance. That should not fall through a middle person or a third party.
The patient was told, and it is stated by the doctor, that the doctor's office made a mistake and told them that they were in-network. As soon as I'm told I'm in-network, I'm fine with the doctor's office. So, again, I am not a doctor. But if I'm told by a doctor's office I am in-network, I would not be calling my insurance company to say, hey, is the doctor's office right? I wouldn't even think about that. I'm in pain. It's an urgent care. The doctor's office told me I'm in network. I'm going. I'm going to continue.
I understand. I can tell you on some of the insurance companies, I am listed as in network. And I know for sure I'm not in network on certain networks. And it's just a misprint. And we always refer them to call the insurance company. Yeah. I understand that.
And Ms. Broman, I can tell you many times, my office would call. Two different times they'd get two different answers, and the patient would call and they'd get a different answer. So, you know, it's this passing the buck here that's going on. So, you know, we don't regulate the insurance company. And this is between them and the doctor. It has nothing to do with the doctor's care.
So, I mean, it's great to have, you know, to hear
I agree, this has nothing to do with the doctor's care.
Yeah. So, and that's what we're looking for is, was there deviation of standard of care here? And it's good to have this robust conversation, and we get out those points that are valid to discuss, but we need to move on here. I think we've covered, you know, all the pertinent points here, and if questions have been answered, does anyone have any additional questions? Okay, so hearing none, I am going to go ahead and offer, or I'm going to make a motion to dismiss case 2418-C, saying there are no violations of state statute.
Seconded.
Thank you, Dr. Foreman. It's been moved and seconded to dismiss case 2418-C, seeing that there are no violations of state statutes. We don't have the complainant on the phone, so if they obviously had any questions, they can always direct that to Heather Broaddus. So, all right. It is now almost 9:30, and we have rescheduled from last...
Dr. Campbell?
Yes, sir.
Dr. Campbell, I apologize. I don't believe you had a vote on that one.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you so much for... I've got my head going faster here. All right. The motion has been made. And
Dr. Campbell?
Yes?
Can I have a quick question? Is the standard of care including billing, or is it just that... they took care of the patient medically?
Well, you could, you know, with pricing sometimes, you know, like if somebody is complaining that there's a large cost to something that's with, you know, out of the community standard, that's different. But we don't regulate. I mean, if we saw inappropriate billing, that's a different issue. That can be a violation of state statutes if there is, you know, they're not using the correct codes and things, or they're upcoding. That's a whole different thing. But this is something that has to do with the insurance industry itself and the relationship between the patient and that insurance. That the doctor is caught in the middle. That's what gets so crazy about this stuff. The relationship of care should be between the patient and the doctor. And the insurance companies have gotten in the way of this, and it really creates quite a conundrum a lot of times. I'll get off my soapbox. So we've made... Did that answer your question?
Not really.
Okay.
I'm just trying to find out. So what you're saying, based on what I just heard, because the billing is not part of standard of care... that includes the insurance, et cetera, or telling somebody that they're in network when they're not. That is not part of anything that we discussed, so this actually should have never come to the board. Is that correct?
Well, anytime we get a complaint, we have to investigate it. So it's not that we can just say, oh, this doesn't have any worth to it. You know, we get a complaint, this is what we do. You have to look at it. But this is a good way, though, to educate everybody in knowing that this isn't something that we regulate, and that this is, you know, but again, we do, if, like I said, inappropriate billing, inappropriate use of codes, that can fall under a standard of care issue, but not this kind of an issue. That's not our, you know, and they tried to remedy the situation. Obviously, the billing department tried to remedy the situation with the patient, and it's kind of on hold. So it's really between them at this point. It's between the patient and the billing company at this time. So, did that answer?
Pretty much. Okay. We don't deal with insurance.
Yeah. We just don't. Yeah, we do not regulate them. We regulate podiatrists.
Oh, I'm not talking about regulating. I'm talking about telling somebody one thing and then finding out.
Yeah, and like I said,
that's the only thing that I'm.
Yeah, and it's concerning. I agree, because like I just told you, or I had mentioned many times in my practice, we call like on an orthotic or something. The patient would be told one thing, and my office staff calling twice would be told something completely different. So you know, it's on.
We just have that with that note.
Yeah.
We just have that with that note. We have a letter saying that they are covered with the exact CPT codes that we use, and they denied it.
Yeah. So, you know, yeah.
The insurance industry is, you know.
Okay, this is board member Jonathan Gray. So just to clarify, really this type of complaint would go to the Department of Insurance. Is that correct?
This is the Secretary General, same as mine. So I think I can jump in here because we're having a lot of conversation here. Billing irregularities, billing issues can 100% fall below the standard of care. I think what Dr. Campbell's trying to reiterate here is that a simple mistake absent any evidence of intent to defraud somebody is not going to be a billing irregularity. Again, this appears to be an accident. They are working through the issue. We don't really have a resolution. Right now, we are presented with the fact that they told them they were in network. They weren't in network. That's what we have. And I understand the question. But again, unless you can point to some intent on their behalf or, you know, the patient losing money, you know, is there any restitution that needs to be involved? And I'm just not seeing that in the case. So I think it's important to remember that even if there's an issue between the insurance company and a patient, that may not be appropriate for the board to refer to DIFI. Again, it may likely just be a civil issue between that person and their insurance carrier. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
All right. So we have some additional discussion there. We do have a motion to dismiss case 24-18-C that was seconded by Dr. Foreman. We've had discussion, so we will now take a vote. All in favor? Aye.
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 All opposed? Ms. Berman, are you abstaining? Did you vote?
I'm sorry, no, I said aye.
Oh, okay. I didn't hear.
I said it at the same time.
Oh.
There were a whole lot of bias.
Where everybody's signing in. Okay. So file number 2418-C has been dismissed. Thank you so much. All right. Now, has Dr. Karp called in yet? We're waiting, you know, last month we were scheduled.
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, wonderful. Hi, Dr. Karp. This is Dr. Campbell. So, as a matter of introduction, Dr. Karp is the medical director at Gateway Recovery Institute, and he's going to present to us about their program for the Physicians Healthcare Program. So we will have his discussion, and then we'll opt for time for questions and answers at the conclusion of his presentation. So welcome, Dr. Karp.
Thank you. And I have to say, I don't have a formal presentation. I just want to talk about our program a little bit and what we offer. I've been working with Gateway now about 5 or 6 years. And what we started with was monitoring for the medical board, and then we do have a few dentists now. The osteopathic board has sent us some folks to monitor, too. I think they do some of their own monitoring. And the PAs, physician assistants, we get, and non-nursing, I think there's probably another program for that. But basically, when a doc gets in trouble with their board for substance abuse or some sort of behavioral issue or whatever, they dictate a full assessment. You know, they want it on an addiction psychiatrist involved in assessing the person. The assessor then gives their recommendations to us about what activities they should be participating in as part of their recovery process. Basically, what we do is we just monitor that they're doing what they're obligated to do in their agreement with the board, that all the docs sign a contract, and that within that contract, the board, the MD board especially, is very specific about the activities that they want the physician to deal with. Or to participate in, I shouldn't say deal with, participate in. They're usually contracted for, if it's not a big issue or it doesn't appear that the person is addicted, by the assessor. They might get 1 or 2 years of just of monitoring, and you know, the more obvious significant addictions might go up to 5 years with the young people anyway. And everyone's a little bit different, so I don't remember all the details about the different boards that I monitor. But it's really the board is our most active. That's who we've been working with. A lot of people are not like coming to Gateway because the I think the mission is great. They weren't in it for the. It was started by a group of anesthesiologists out here in Gilbert Mesa area because there was only one program, like the Fletcher's program, for years, well known, had been the only one, I think, again, I wasn't there at the beginning, but I think the board put out a request for, what do they call it, requesting contracts, I forget. And then Gateway, VSOC applied. So I think the price, I don't know specifically, I really don't get into the behind-the-scenes details. Marisha, my assistant, it's not my assistant, she basically is the organizer. She stays on top of all that stuff. So I can't tell you what the fees are and stuff specifically, but I know we would have, when it first came on, we were significantly cheaper for the docs than what Dr. Sutcher's program. I think it's CDI now. I think he sold that practice to CDI. I just don't know much about it. But we'll get a message from the board that they have somebody that goes on a program for monitoring as opposed to the other one. Marisha signed them up, and usually the board dictates what, 3 urine tests a month or whatever to start with. It just varies very much depending on the assessment that comes in from the addiction psychiatrist. So we do urines, we have a great lab, I think. Dr. Ferguson is brilliant when it comes to this stuff, because we'll get docs, we'll get a positive, and the docs will say, well, I was washing my hands with alcohol, and it was absorbed. And he knows all the details, the statistics, the research around things like that, so he will guide us with that, if it's significant or not. So typically, I don't think we have anybody that does any more than 3 times a month, but sometimes if we're really worried about somebody, we can have them get a urine test every week. Another long-term test for alcoholism is a PET test, and I always forget what that stands for. But it can tell within the last few months if somebody's been drinking and alcohol. And it's kind of quantitative, too. The score itself can tell. Dr. Ferguson always seems confident in the info he provides to us that, yeah, this person just didn't sip a glass of champagne. This is more significant than that. Let's see, I'm trying to think. And then the other part of the monitoring that I'm mostly involved with is face-to-face visits. Every 6 months, at least that's what we've been doing for the years I've been here, every 6 months. I know the MD board wants me to meet face-to-face, which is typically a virtual meeting. So every 6 months or twice a year, I sit down with the doc. And I'm not doing treatment, I'm just going through, I brought with me my list of questions that they might be doing in their monitoring, if you'd like me to go through those as examples.
Yeah, that would be great, thank you.
So, again, this is just the questions I ask in monitoring and then expand on if I need to. How long are you sober? Pretty obvious statement. Are they currently practicing? Because some of the people we get have been, practice was suspended because the board was concerned about them. So some that come to us have had their license on hold, I guess you say, until the full assessment, and we see if it's potentially dangerous to patient care. Most of them not, but anyway. Most of the people that show up with us are still practicing and haven't had their license sanctioned or whatever. Is there a question?
Yeah, I do. This is Dr. Campbell. So you do both board mandated evaluations, and do you and
I don't do the evaluations because the evaluations are really detailed and I'm old and I don't like to write reports. So they've asked me if I wanted to be on the list. The again, the MD board, which I'm most familiar with, they have a list of approved assessors. So typically, if they haven't had their assessment yet and we're involved with them, ERISA will give them a list of the various approved assessors that the board approves. And then they have to go get that assessment, and it usually is a 5 or 6 page detailed report. Like I said, I was asked if I wanted to do those, and I said no, I'm too old to be writing reports like that.
I should have asked it this way, I guess. So does Gateway take self-referrals from doctors?
We do, yes. Arizona is different than some other states. There's like two models that I've been familiar with. I came from Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania has a model where they contract with a medical society to do the monitoring. So there's kind of a buffer between the physician and the board itself. And a lot of states are doing that, moving to that more and more. And most of them that I'm aware of do it that way. So that the board never hears about it or sanctions the doc as long as he completes the monitoring that's set up within the medical society. This is in Pennsylvania. In Arizona, it's different. The doc has to go directly to the board. And I think that, you know, that decreases the amount of self-reporting docs because, you know, they're going to get their name on the internet as being dinged or whatever. But Arizona is currently, I refer to the MD board because that's what mostly 99% of what I do. They're considering putting an intermediary in between so that the doctors can kind of feel safe going to self-report. And as long as they do everything that the monitor wants them to do and they complete their contract without any issues, it never actually gets formally to the board in those states. But in Arizona, you got to go to the board first, and the board doles out the monitoring between the CDI group and us. So I kind of like the more anonymous approach because I think docs are, it's kind of been proven, they've researched that a little bit, the physical health, the federation of state physical health programs, or physician health programs. So we'll get the referral from the board about what the person's been through. Sometimes they have a temporary order to just get them hooked up in the system, and then after they're fully evaluated, details of what they're after. Let me go through what these are the various things that we can and the board can mandate for the time and monitoring. We want to know their primary care physician, although Marissa always gets that, so I don't always ask them that. Then there's a number of relapse prevention groups for physicians specifically in Arizona. Mm-hmm. So usually they have to do 2 years of relapse prevention group. And it's, I typically like that the best of what they have to do because it's run by really well-seasoned, the ones that are here are well-seasoned addiction professionals. And most of them feel they get a lot out of that. Then we have a requirement for how many AA or NA meetings they need to go to, 12-step meetings. Typically, it'll be minimum of 3 a week. And then once a month, required to do a Caduceus 12-step meeting, which is basically the professional group AA group. So from Arizona, mainly doctors, but some other professionals go to the Caduceus meeting as well. That's a good meeting in the beginning when I first meet people, first meet the doc coming in, so I get to a Caduceus meeting as soon as you can because that's a resource for you. You'll talk to the other docs that have been going through the monitoring and you can get an idea what that's like. Mm-hmm. And then some people are required to do bi-weekly, monthly individual counseling like with an addiction counselor. And then other people, we've had a few people with significant mental health issues. They typically are required to see a psychiatrist as well as a therapist on a regular basis, whether in the monitoring program. Then I check to see that they've completed an IOP program. Most of them come in to us or in either. And by that time, they're at a residential and in an intensive outpatient program. And again, I count on the assessors, the docs out there that do the assessments are really good, and when they suggest something, typically put it on the mandatory monitoring list. There's such a thing as a 36-hour drug and alcohol education program. There's several providers that do that. I think that's a good thing for all the docs that come through. A lot of them come in, they're pretty naive to the whole addiction process and the recovery process. So I think that helps them get assimilated into what we're asking them to do. Some are the more mental health ones or behavioral ones are mandated to see a psychiatrist. Then I typically ask if there's any new stressors in life that could be a trigger to use. Most of them answer early on at the 40s. You think they're major stressors, so, and I can understand that with the risk of your life, since I can't imagine that happening. I want to mention, too, that Marisha and I are here to support the docs and help them be successful. A lot of them that I start talking with, they have an attitude because they think I'm the police or whatever, and I explain to them, no, my job is to keep you away from the police, so to speak. So anything that you're not doing and pick up on the monitoring form, I have to document that. We don't necessarily have to run back to the board and say you're not doing this, but you're mandated to do it, so I expect next time I talk with you 6 months from now that you're doing all these things. So in the beginning, it takes a while for them to get organized and understand the system and exactly what they're supposed to be doing. Then I ask for a list of their prescription medicines, and then the other issue as far as the medicines go, there are docs that, you know, and get into an accident or need pain medication for a procedure or something, dental or surgery, they are required to let us know up front, and then they are required to send us a picture from their phone with the prescription bottle so we know what we're, you know, exactly what they're taking. Mm-hmm. I just remember one guy in the 5 years I've been here, an older guy too, he just kept using. And he said, well, my doctor gave this to me. I said, but you got to understand the rules are, you got to run it by us first and say, okay, for that, yes, you're allowed to use this for a short period of time. This guy kept doing it. He finally, the board pulled his license because he just wasn't getting it. And then I do, a brief assessment of their kind of emotional state. I go through that specific question. Depression, anxiety, guilt, or shame. Guilt and shame and resentment can be a trigger to relapse. And that's a big issue in AA that they work on in the group. But I just wanted to ask about that. And then next, I do a really gross assessment of life satisfaction in the categories of family, marriage, work or career, friendships, and recreation. And I really stress that they need to be doing something to recreate. I've been to many staff meetings in the last few years, and there's a big focus now on physician health and wellness. And what's really gratifying to me is seeing some of the guys come back from treatment kind of with converted into, you know, I don't need to kill myself doing this job. I'm going to cut back and spend more time with the family and stuff. So the therapy they get in treatment is really valuable if they pay attention to it. If they're arrogant and they just when it goes through the motions, they can do that too, actually, as long as their testing is clean. We don't need to pick the issue. I mean, there's some kids come in that are really resistant. They're doing everything they need to do, and I just try to be congenial with them when I'm monitoring them and saying, you know, this isn't so bad. This is explaining why you do this in treatment and why they want you to do that. And most of the people sort of get it after that they're on monitoring program for a while. And, you know, I can't remember, maybe 3 or 4 in the past 6 years that we have to, Marisha and I have to report to the board because they just weren't being compliant. Most people, and it's proven through research, too, that the most successful addiction treatment programs are the physician programs and the pilot programs. And I believe it's because you got a lot to lose. Nobody wants to lose their license and their income. So they're very motivated to do what they have to do to make it through the program. And then at the end, when they're monitored, some people can leave early in their contract. They have to kind of appeal to the board itself and then get another full evaluation. So that can be a little bit costly, a couple $1,000 for the time that these docs do between writing the report and spending time with the doc. And I've had some people that did great. You know, they're a 5-year contract. They did great. Had no concerns about them. They're doing everything they're asking to do. And you can kind of, if you work in addictions, you can feel when somebody's made that conversion. So I understand what I got here, and I have to stay on top of it. And so if they're doing really well across the board, then sometimes the board will cut it short. I don't make that decision. I give a recommendation. Yes, the Fed's been doing great, or Gal's been doing great in their monitoring. I don't really have a concern. I don't think it should be in jeopardy or whatnot if they end their monitoring program. And then we have some docs that I think this is pretty smart. That we have several docs that we continue to do testing on. And I asked, why are you doing this? First doc, why are you doing this? He goes, well, I want proof that I'm not using anymore. So if I go get a new job, I can have a year's worth or 2 years worth of drug tests that show that I'm not using it. So man, that's pretty smart. So we do have several docs that stick around just for monitoring, and they're out from under their contract, so to speak, but they just want a paper trail to show that they're staying sober, so that if they want to do something different, they have that information available. So that's pretty much it, as it goes with the Gateway program. I'm not sure how CBI, if they do the same things or not, but that's basically what we do at Gateway.
So how often do you have to, do you report back to the board, send a report?
We don't really have to report to the board unless they're non-compliant.
Okay.
So we try to stay away from the board to their state as much as we can, because the history in Arizona, I think with BMDs and stuff, is they can be pretty rigid. So my job is my job is to keep you away from the board. You get in front of the board and you make a mistake, that's going to hurt. Yeah. So I stress that in the beginning when I meet them for the first time. I say, look, I'm going to tell you you need to be doing these things because it's mandated in your agreement with the board. But they're never going to hear from me or Marisha until something goes awry. Mm-hmm. And we're obligated with our contract directly to the MD board to report any positive tests. So that immediately goes to the board. And then typically the doc will say, well, I didn't do anything. I didn't use probably hand sanitizer. That's the most common statement.
Yeah.
And then that's when I get Dr. Ferguson involved. Could this be from the lab director? He has been doing this for so long, he has a good feel for it. Marcia and I really trust what his input is in those situations.
So do you think there's any one age group that's more affected by substance abuse in medical practice, or is it just all across?
We have some residents in the program that maintain their good standing by self-reporting and stay on their program. Others are kicked out of the program until they finish monitoring. I guess it just depends on the program and how much they want to support their residents. I do believe addiction's a disease, and that's my approach. I've been an addiction psychiatrist for 30 years, so I had my awakening on my addiction rotation when I made some comments about one of the patients at the rehab I was working at. And it wasn't a kind comment, too. It was my first week of supervision, and the addiction psychiatrist, my supervisor, a very nice guy, very smart guy, looked at me and he goes, judgmental, aren't you? At that point, I realized this is a whole different deal. I've got to take my preconceptions of addiction and out of being bad people out of the picture. And I basically tell my patients, you're a good person, you got a bad disease. Mm-hmm. And I know how that disease operates. I'm going to ask you some of these questions that you might even get offended by. No, I'm not drinking. This is more typically with my regular patients that come in. And every time, the first question is, do you use it all? And then, you don't trust me. I said, no, I don't trust your disease. I try to establish that rapport as a patient. I said, you're a good person with a bad disease, and we're here to help you fix that.
So it sounds like they really stay busy in between you seeing them at 6 months if they're seeing their own, you know, a psychiatrist or, that they're
not
busy.
Not everybody has that account.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not everybody has to be mandated for counseling or a psychiatrist or whatnot. And really, the most consistent thing and the most important data, I think, is the testing. If they're coming back clean and everything else is going well, that's really what I'm concerned about. So we get a positive test back. There's some Marisha. She calls me or texts me immediately. I try to get on the phone with the doc and say, please explain yourself. Mm-hmm. And then I have the option to recommend to the board This person needs to go back to intensive outpatient, or this person, we should add this to their mandatory list, and so on. The boards are pretty good. If somebody makes one mistake, that doesn't necessarily lose them their license, but if they have a history of that, and it's a consistent thing they're saying, that's when they get more involved.
Mm-hmm.
What is the rate of recidivism?
It's very rare. I can only think of two or three docs over the past 5 years that I've been doing this that had positive tests show up. And, we would send them back maybe to residential or to IOP or whatnot. And only one doc, he was doing something prescribing-wise that was an issue. And they suspended him for a year as a penalty for whatever he was doing. I can't remember the specifics about it. I guess he was in monitoring. He wasn't supposed to write for certain, I don't know if it was controlled substances or what. To be honest with you, I don't remember a lot of the details of each of these cases. I just know whether they're tested positive or negative, and they look like they're doing their stuff when I meet with them. And anytime, and Marissa is great. She gets suspicious. She knows behaviors. And that's just probably what's happened. She goes, yep, I think that's true. And then we have to report to the board or something. We do. But that's basically how we operate at Gateway.
Anybody else have any questions for the doctor? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, Dr. Karp.
No, that's okay. I was just going to say that Marissa is a gem. You know, I'm sure all you docs know when you have an office staff that's the head of the ball game and has your prep and everything ready and knows what you need and what you're going to be asking for. She knows everything, and she's a very conscientious person. So she's my eyes and ears and outlook, and then she will bring me in now if somebody shows a positive test to talk to that person in between our visits.
Anybody else have questions for Dr. Carr?
This is board member Johnson Gray. I do not have questions.
Thank you. Dr. Foreman?
No questions. Very complete.
And Ms. Broman?
Thank you very much. That was very informative.
Yes.
I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thanks. We really do appreciate your time. So,
these programs are getting more and more sophisticated. There is an organization for all the physician health programs called the Federation for Physician Health Programs. If you want to, they have a website. So even if you have questions about a particular issue or doctor, you can kind of, an executive secretary is just great too, of feeding back information. They can tell you how every state that's in the group, which is I think most states, how they take care of different situations. And we're all different. I used to work in state government at the Office of Mental Health in Pennsylvania. I was the medical director for a few years. And as we used to, they used to meet with the docs from the other states, and I learned early on that you've seen one state. Everybody does it a little bit differently, the way they've evolved it. So this is basically what I gave you, is the gateway process for people we're monitoring.
Okay. And I have a question for Seamus Monahan, our AG. I just was wondering, do we need to take any action to approve participation with this program? Do I need to make a motion?
No, I don't, and I don't believe it's agendized that way.
No,
today.
Okay.
We can put that on a future item, but then the item for you to, just kind of memorialize it.
Yeah, I do think we have written contracts with the other boards that we work with, just defining what our role is and stuff. So if you were going to take that step, I'm sure you can send people to us without that agreement. I know that the PA is, we don't have a written agreement for the PA licensing, but I guess that's under the medical board, but honestly. But in any event, we can do individuals, or if you want us to be your contractors, I don't think you get charged. And again, you could talk to Marissa, and she could give you all the details of how to connect with us if you decide to do that.
Okay.
Yeah, and the way the states generally run these programs is that all costs are borne by the respondent.
Yes.
And they'd be responsible for paying you guys for everything.
Exactly. That's how it works, yeah.
Okay.
And then over time, if they're doing well, you know, we can decrease the lab tests and reduce the cost for them so we get more confident that they're doing everything they need to do and they're getting the end of their contract. We'll lop off some lab tests, maybe from 3 times a month to once a month. And again, it's just monitoring progress and making adjustments if it's appropriate.
Well, again, thank you so much for your time, Dr. Karp, and this very informative presentation. We really appreciate that very much.
My pleasure, and if you have any questions about Gateway, call Marissa. She knows everything.
Okay. Great. Thanks again.
Well, it's a nice meeting you both, and nice talking with you both, and everybody have a great day.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All righty. Everybody ready to move on to, we have one final complaint to discuss here, and that is complaint 25-01-C, which is Dr. Alan Shea, and Dr. Saunders is our investigator on that case.
Okay, yes, 25-01-C, this one is...
Is he on the phone?
Not as much of a fun topic again. This seems to be, another insurance complaint issue. Patient's husband filed a complaint regarding the billing for his wife's appointment, DB, patient DB, on 7/2/24. They received the bill for the CAM booth that was dispensed, and that was also denied by their insurance company. And the patient's husband was upset because they were under the impression from the staff that the booth was going to be a covered benefit. The response from the office was noted that the staff did check benefits, and they made no guarantees of the coverage, and an EBN was signed regarding such. After it became clear that it was denied, the office offered a 50% discount due to the higher-than-expected fees, which I believe is still in pending payment for that. The review of the case itself, speaking with Dr. Shea, staff remembers this case and the complaint. Husband was not necessarily present during the visit. The patient was seen, left the office, and then actually came back in, and then got the CAM boot. Subsequently, so the patient was seen for some heel pain, received an injection, left the office, felt extreme pain, was still uncomfortable, so they dispensed the CAM boot when the patient came back in. At that point. So I reviewed the office notes and the billing with CPTs, and they're appropriate. Patient was seen for heel pain on the right side and some nerve pain on the left side. Everything is well documented. As I mentioned, the patient did receive the heel injection, and it was documented that the patient did receive a CAM boot as well. And inmates mentioned that they actually called the insurance company up to check for it. They were told that the boot was a covered benefit, but then after it was denied, when they're going back to review it, hey, you told us this, he said, she said, the insurance company typically does cover CAM boots, but it has to have the disclaimer that it has to be a fracture. And that's what the insurance company got back. At least that's what when they were appealing the denial. That's what it was told to the office for this. So the evaluation and treatment for care was well within the standards. The billing for the CAM boot, in my opinion, is a standard of care as well. This patient, again, they opted to use their insurance company for the evaluation and the treatment. And again, I believe it's the patient's agreement with their insurance company that the insurance company is putting different disclaimers as to what they believe the CAM boot should be used for and what they will pay for one. It's a common episode, not the first time today. And I do think that the responsibility of this falls to the insurer.
And I think it's interesting to note in the doctor's note that the patient indicated she would most... He signs the ABN form,
yeah.
And then she states, well, I'm not, probably not going to wear it. Well, so why did she sign it and take the boot?
She took the boot.
And so she's, that's making a contract. You know, you accept a, you accept a product.
I agree. I mean, you know, wearing it for 2 or 3 days is probably all she would do. Right?
Yeah.
It helped her in the immediate.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there was the he said, she said about, you know, did the patient's husband ask them to change the diagnosis code so it recovered? And he said, no, I didn't do that. So, again, like you said, all the he said, she said there. So, Dr. Foreman, do you have any comments or questions?
Yes, this is a common thing that goes on in the office. We get denials every day for things like this that the insurance says are covered. So I have no questions. That was just a comment.
Thank you. Ms. Johnson-Gray?
I do not have any questions.
Thank you. Ms. Broman?
Sounds like it's another insurance thing, so no questions.
Yeah. Okay. So, like I said, we do not, the doctors did not call in. Okay. Dr. Shi, are you on the phone? Okay. Would anybody have any questions for the doctor?
No,
Board Member Johnson-Gray. I do not have any questions for the doctor.
And I did, I do have a question for Dr. Saunders. That the code that was used, the, what is it, L, I just have it here, 4361, that is the standard,
yeah,
the standard code that's used these days.
That's a pneumatic off-the-shelf boot, which I carry in my office, but it's very common.
Okay. So just so that our non-physician board members are aware of what that's standard, so. All right, so is there any other discussion before we move on here with the motion?
That's Dr. C.
Okay.
Was that Dr. C that just joined the conference call?
I did just join.
Okay, thank so you didn't hear any of the discussion, so. Basically, Dr. Saunders presented the fact of the concern of the patient that their CAM boot was not covered, and basically with their, I'm sure you read Dr. Saunders's investigation report anyway, and we were just talking about the fact that the patient did sign the ABN form and informed you, as it's documented in your chart, notes that she probably wasn't going to wear it anyway, and you know that this is, you know, these insurance companies do this all the time, tell, you know, people, you know, you don't guarantee payment because it's a covered item, because they can change their minds, or, you know, depending on what the diagnosis is. So if you would like to make any comments about this, you can go ahead, even though you did not hear our discussion. If you would like to say anything, please do so now.
Yeah, no, I don't have too much to add. I think that, we do what we can. It's like, it's not us, the insurance company, we're just trying to get people better, so.
Right, yeah. And I know you offered it, you offered the discounting of price. I mean, that was, you did offer that to them too, so that, and not everybody, you don't necessarily have to do that, but most people do through, out of goodwill and trying to, show that, yes, your concern is the care of the patient, not always monetary. So does anyone have any questions for Dr. Shea? I'm so sorry to mispronounce your name. Dr. Foreman?
No questions.
Okay. Ms. Johnson-Gray?
I don't have any questions. Just a comment to what you just stated, the offer of the discount, I think is honorable and shows that the doctor did have the care of the patient in mind. So.
Ms. Broman?
Online here or no?
Okay. All righty then. So I will go ahead and make a motion to dismiss case 25-01-C seeing that there are no violations. I second. Thank you, Ms. Roman. It's been moved and seconded to dismiss case 25-01-C. Is there no violations of state statutes? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Okay. Opposed? Sorry. The complaint is dismissed. All right. Thank you, Dr. Shee, for chiming in there. Sorry we missed you earlier, but we got it done. All righty.
No worries.
Okay.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. So we're going to go back here to 4, which is the general session board meeting minutes of February 12, 2025. Does anybody have any additions or corrections to those minutes? Okay. Hearing none, I'll make a motion to accept the minutes as written, seeing there are no additions or corrections. Do we have a second?
Seconded.
Thank you, Dr. Foreman. Moved and seconded to accept general session board meeting minutes of February 12, 2025. All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? No opposing votes, so our minutes have been accepted. We'll move back now to, we have one license under subheading 5B, Dr. Keith Crenshaw, who is still in his residency and will complete that on June the 30th of 2025. He's in good standing. All the fees have been paid. Does anyone have any questions or concerns with this initial application for licensure? Alrighty. Hearing none, I'll make a motion to accept the initial application for licensure for Dr. Crenshaw and to issue the license upon completion of his residency and payment of the license issuance fee.
Seconded.
Thank you. It's moved and seconded to accept the initial application for Dr. Keith Crenshaw. All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? Dr. Crenshaw's application has been accepted. All right. So now, don't miss anything here. Okay. The next is 7, which is the update on the Federation of Podiatric Medical Boards meeting that was held on the 26th of February. Community of practice session. Heather and I were both in attendance at that virtual meeting, and the topics that were covered, we discussed the updates on the podiatric medical licensing compact with Dr. LeBeau, who made a presentation and just state, you know, where we are in the process, and that their goal is to have at least four states able to run legislation in the year 2026. The community of practice session involved topics such as a board structure and composition. And one of the items that came up from that discussion is in Nevada. Nevada has no state podiatric medical association to, fight this or whatever, but they want to repeal the podiatric medical board and merge it with other integrative professions such as acupuncture and some other boards. So that was something that was discussed. Heather mentioned the legislation that she will discuss later here in her report about, you know, the bill that was to decrease the number of doctors and increase public members on the boards. Under that topic, it was also talked about what's the process for board appointments. And there's a modification in Oklahoma now where the governor can appoint from any submitted names rather than the names that are directly submitted from the state association. The next topic was licensing processes and board operations. There was a discussion about fees. Do state boards still perform, give examinations like jurisprudence exams, and are those exams given by a third party? They talked about are meetings now back to a total in person, or are they still hybrids or virtual meetings?
And then there was discussion regarding regulatory challenges and legislative oversight. There is, in New Mexico, there's a proposed bill that's really, it's in conflict with their current licensing states, their statutes. What they're wanting to just give the title of doctor only to MDs and DOs. So that's something that is kind of, you know, being monitored. There is also in the state of Maryland what's called a ratback program. That's a mandated criminal reporting and violations committed by licensees to report to the board within real time. And then the other component to that discussion was about board's involvement in legislative review. They were curious, people were curious, do the state boards vote on proposed legislation, or do they use like a legislative committee, which as their primary conduit to review and taking a position on the legislation that's going on in their state. So do you have anything to add to that, Heather?
No, I think you were very thorough.
Okay.
Yep.
All righty. So does anyone have any questions on that?
Just a comment. I can't believe that they would take the podiatry board and merge it with something like acupuncture, where licenses and everything are so different.
Oh, yeah. It's, yeah, some of this stuff is, you wonder who came up, who had these ideas. So, yeah.
Yeah.
There's some interesting issues going all over the country with these things. And, you know, well, of course, and Heather will present in that legislative memo, you know, the different boards that they want to try to repeal here. So I'll leave that to Heather's discussion. So, all righty. So we're actually, what a segue. We'll move right into 8 for Heather's legislative memo.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, board members. There has been some movement on some of the bills, so I'm just going to go through and point out the ones that would mainly affect the board. And if you have questions on any of the other ones, just please feel free to interrupt, let me know. So the first one is Senate Bill 1054, and this one actually Dr. Campbell brought to my attention. This would allow assisted living homes and assisted living centers to offer mild hyperbaric oxygen therapy to their residents. That bill did pass the Senate and was transmitted to the House. As of yesterday, the House has not heard that bill yet. Senate Bill 1235, this bill was amended. This was the bill that initially would change the board member composition. It would decrease the amount of professional members and increase the amount of public members. So it was amended, and it just states that at least 50% of the licensed or certified board members be a former licensee who is retired or is licensed to practice but is not currently practicing. And I've been asked that question before, if a retired, so somebody who no longer has their license, they've allowed it to expire, could be a board member. And with this amendment, yes, that would be an option. All board members must be confirmed by the Senate. And it would allow a health board to fill a public member position if the governor fails to fill a public member position within 1 year after the position becomes vacant. And it would establish a health board oversight council. This also did pass the Senate and was transmitted to the House. The next one is Senate Bill 1527. This board has never suspended processing of renewal applications, but this bill would extend any renewal during that suspension period. So basically a licensee's license would not expire if the processing of renewals were suspended. And this also passes...
Which again is only going to happen in very limited circumstances, like when you request FBI approval for fingerprint clearance cards and you have to wait for it.
Yes, and...
That's what it seems like there. trying to shore up is the issues that, you know, some of the boards had with them.
Mm-hmm. Because if I recall correctly, there was at least one board that did suspend licensing, issuing initial licenses and renewal licenses, waiting for that FBI approval. So that one did pass the Senate, is in the House, and is still waiting for a third read. Senate Bill 1587, this is the bill that would have privatized application processes for boards. This did not pass. And then the other one is House Bill 2031. This is the bill that would have repealed Barbering and Cosmetology Board as well as the Acupuncture Board, and this also did not pass. House Bill 2173, this has to do with a question regarding mental health assistant or treatment on a initial application and a renewal application. This board currently does not ask that question. It has a question that asks about, you know, issues, but not this specifically. So this did pass the House and was transmitted to the Senate and is still waiting for a third read. House Bill 2351, this did not pass. This is the bill that would have removed the 5-year time frame posting requirement on health boards' websites regarding disciplinary and non-disciplinary action. So this did not pass. And then,
number again is that? Make sure I have that right.
That was House Bill 2351.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. So the 5-year time frame requirement will remain in effect unless there's another striker bill. But I'll continue to monitor. And then the last one I wanted to point out was House Bill 2637. This would have repealed the Board of Dispensing Opticians. This also did not pass. So I can answer any questions on any of those or any of the other ones that are listed.
Thanks, Heather, for keeping up on those.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they can't present any other bills.
They could in the striker bill.
That's the only way. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But that's probably going to only be for the next 2 or 3 weeks, and then time will run out.
Yes.
Yeah.
So by the April meeting, there shouldn't be any new bills introduced. Mm-hmm.
All right. Does anybody have any questions for Heather?
Yes, I just had a question about, it is HB 2031. So it looks like it failed, but then it looks like they're reconsidering it.
There was a motion to reconsider, but it's not been assigned, so... And for my understanding is that it did not pass, but I'll keep that one on my list, and I'll keep monitoring it because it was heard in committee, so in theory it could be brought back, but I don't, mm-hmm. I'm 99.9% sure that it did not pass, that the motion to reconsider is just going to sit there.
Okay, you know, that's one that I'm watching. Because I am currently a licensed nail technician, so it is one that I'm watching. So thank you for continuing to keep us updated on that particular bill.
Yes, of course.
All right. So next up is Seamus, number 9, the presentation regarding conflict of interest.
Yes, if you just give me a second. 20, and I'll be ready to go. Okay, thank you. Thank you for indulging me. So I'm going to work off the memo today, and I apologize that I'm not there in person. I prefer to be there in person, so I apologize that I'm not today.
So let me pull this up here. So I'll try to keep this somewhat brief. I know we've had a lot of training. You guys have the memo. You know, you are very good readers. So I'm going to hit the high points. Again, this memo is going to be the gold standard. And if you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me. I always start conflict of interest conversations by first saying, you know, these aren't matters for legal advice per se in executive session. They are your conflict. You need to make the decision, but Heather and I will be there to assist you in analyzing that and, you know, helping you come to the right decision or considerations. And, you know, just to start, I've noticed sometimes an example helps. So as far as conflicts of interest go, I actually have, myself, I have two standing conflicts. And so it kind of dovetails because my two standing conflicts involve my father-in-law and my wife. They're both, one's an accountant, one's a social worker. They're both licensed by the state of Arizona, and my office actually my specific office with us 13 attorneys regulates my wife and my father-in-law. So I have on file a standing conflict that if any case or matter comes before a board, before the board, you know, involving my father-in-law or my wife, I'll be immediately screened off. I can't review anything. I can't even open files from the computer just to look. So I would like to provide that as an example. So the Title 38, Section 503, provides the relevant conflict of interest statutes. And there's two main parts to the conflict of interest statute. And first, that any public officer or employee of a public agency who has or whose relative has a substantial interest in a contract, sale, purchase, or service to such public agency shall make known the interest in the official records of such public agency and shall refrain from voting upon or otherwise participating in any manner as an officer or employee in such contract, sale, or purchase. The other is any public officer or employee who has or whose relative has a substantial interest in any decision of a public agency shall make known such interest in the official records of such public agency and shall refrain from participating in any manner as an officer or employee in such decision. So B is really the one that's going to affect you the most, right? Because you make decisions, you make regulatory decisions and adjudication enforcement decisions against persons. And if you have a substantial interest in a matter that comes before the board, and we'll get to what substantial interest means, it'll make more sense as we go through. But if you know you have a substantial interest or the person, you know the person before the board in a way other than, that's material, then you would want to disclose that and recuse. Under this law, it states a public officer employee who has a conflict of interest must disclose this interest and refrain from participating in the matter. Which brings me back to how do you announce your recusal, right? Well, you're going to put it on the record by saying, I'm recusing from this matter and will not be voting. At the end of the meeting, best practice would be to fill out a sheet that would go into the board's files that states what your conflict was and what agenda item that was that day. The other thing, too, is that every year it's best practice to have a standing conflict of interest policy. For some people, that could be, your employer. If there were a case, let's say, not to pick on Dr. Foreman, but let's say there were a case against Dr. Foreman, not necessarily against Dr. Foreman, but against someone in his office for practicing outside the scope of their duties, right? Let's say they're technically practicing podiatry. Could Dr. Foreman get in trouble for that? Yes, he may also be named in the complaint, but let's say that he's not. Well, Dr. Foreman has a substantial interest because that's an employee of his business. There's money at stake. There's reputation at stake. There's plenty of reason for Dr. Foreman to excuse that employee and vote, you know, in his own interest and not in the interest of the public, which is why that conflict of interest requires recusal. So that would be, you know, that could be one of those examples. So, you know, what everybody asks me all the time, I sit on an association with them. That's fine. Knowing them, being on an association with them, having extracurricular activities with them, that's not going to be something that's considered a conflict of interest. That may be different when you're down to appearance of impropriety or bias. But what we're talking about right here is more concrete issues. Something you have skin in the game and making a decision in favor of the individual before you, or, you know, not in favor of them, stands to benefit you. That is when you would have a substantial interest. The purpose of the conflict of law, the object of conflict of interest statutes, is to remove or limit the possibility of personal influence, which might bear upon an official's decision. Arizona's conflict of interest laws serve to prevent self-dealing by public officials. The financial interests of public officers or employees must not conflict with the unbiased performance of their public duties, because one cannot serve two masters with conflicting interests. Another question I get a lot that's very interesting is when a board member is no longer on board, or if they are on board, let's say against Dr. Foreman, there is a complaint against Dr. Foreman. Board members would sometimes come to me and say, do I need to recuse because I'm on board with him? Well, no, because that in and of itself does not create a conflict, unless because of your duty, you know, because of your relationship to him on the board, you don't feel that you can be unbiased. That's a different situation. If you feel that you can't make a decision in the best interest of the public health and safety solely, then you should be considering whether you should hear that matter. But again, just by nature of being on board with somebody does not mean that you should disclose yourself, that you should conflict yourself. And furthermore, if you all try to conflict yourself, I would say that you have broached the rule of impossibility, which means you've all conflicted yourself out. Nobody can hear the case now. So I'm going to make you all come back in and hear the case and decide anyways, even if you conflict yourself out. So... but that I've never seen happen. It should never happen. If it does, we'll deal with it at that point. But I've never had a case where every board member has recused themselves. A board member has a conflict of interest with a case to be brought before it must disclose that interest and recuse themselves from participating in the proceeding. As we discussed, the public participation is prohibited for any decision or contract where you have a direct or indirect pecuniary proprietary interest. You know, maybe you decide you want to start doing medical continuing education hours. If you wanted the board to approve you as a continuing education provider for podiatrists, that likely would be a conflict of interest. You would not be able to be involved in that decision. It would have to be the board that would decide that on your behalf. A board member who has or whose relative has a substantial interest in a decision of the board has a conflict of interest and must publicly disclose that interest and refuse from participating in the matter. A substantial interest is defined as, in general, means any pecuniary or proprietary interest, either direct or indirect. And again, if you think that you have a conflict that involves any kind of, you know, money or, you know, rights of yourself that, you know, could be enhanced based on making a decision, please just call me if you're worried about that. You know, I highly doubt that we're going to have issues related to any contract or sale or service provided. It's more just going to be about these people who come before you. You know, for instance, on the chiropractic board, there used to be an individual who worked for a very large company that owned a ton of very well-known chiropractic establishments. And so to avoid the conflict of interest and the appearance of impropriety, that individual, that board member, had a blanket rule that anybody who came before him, came before the board who owned one of those facilities, that he would recuse himself, even if it wasn't a facility that he was a partner in, maybe it's another franchise, because he felt that, you know, he could be seen as making decisions that benefit the global brand as a whole. So that was, and that was his decision, to recuse from all cases, even where he didn't have a direct interest. He felt he had an indirect interest. So it's just something to think about. Relative means spouse, child, parent, grandparent, sibling, or in-law of the board member. So unless you're in business with your cousin, likely not going to mean your cousin. Disqualification is automatic and mandatory when a statutory conflict of interest exists. So when you have a statutory conflict, when you have that monetary interest, or you have a substantial interest in a decision, you gotta back off and disqualify yourself. I've only seen once where a board member did not declare conflict, and the newspaper later, this was a few years ago, and the newspaper later requested their conflict of interest disclosures and was able to pretty quickly discern that they had an interest in a lot of the cases that they were not taking action on. And that board member just quit himself, and I've never seen him again. But I wouldn't want to see any of you get into that position. There's no reason to. So you'll make that conflict of interest and board decision known in the board's official records. May file either a written document with the board disclosing the interest, which that would be my recommendation. It will be in the official minutes. So I don't believe a copy of the official minutes is necessary to disclose that interest. It will be in there anyway. Disqualified board member must not communicate in any manner with anyone involved in the decision-making process. I know you guys know what that means. So when you're screened off, you're screened off. And even after the meeting, during bathroom break, do not talk about it with anybody on the board. The consequences that the board's decision could be reversed. And that's one of the likely, most obvious ones, is that yes, we will be found to have acted arbitrary and capricious and potentially illegally, and they will reverse our decision. You will likely get a civil lawsuit filed against yourself and possibly even the board, as well as, you know, any federal constitutional rights that you violated, you know, technically, you know, fair trade practices, right to earn a living, those, you know, those become very important ones. And you can be criminally prosecuted if your conflict is so egregious that it rises to that level. A public official shall not use or attempt to use his or her official position to secure any valuable thing or valuable benefit for themselves, which they would not otherwise receive in the ordinary performance of their duties, if the thing or benefit might have a substantial and improper influence upon them. To me, the one that you always got to watch out for, you know somebody, they have a case before the board. While they have a case before the board, you know, hey, let me take you out to dinner. Or, hey, we noticed you're on the board. You want some free tickets to this, you know, this podiatric association meeting or something like that. Just be very careful. Reach out to Heather. You know, maybe it's appropriate that you go as a representative of the board, and so we could figure it out that way, as opposed to accepting something on your own behalf for free. A public official may not directly or indirectly receive compensation for their participation on the board in addition to what you are already paid. I'm not sure whether you paid, so. Bias, prejudice, and predetermination. So this is when we're coming out of the actual conflict. And these are where the area is more gray. And so even though you may not have a conflict, you may need to disqualify yourself from participating.
for any board member to do this because it would be interfering with the licensee's right to due process and a fair hearing. So if you come in to the meeting, and I'm sure you have a lot of preconceived notions about cases before you talk to the individual, that's totally understandable. But if you come into a meeting, you're, regardless of what you hear, you know, this individual needs to be punished right now, and you don't feel that you can be unbiased in making that decision, then that's a consideration for recusal. It's not an automatic recusal, and I'm not going to tell you you have to. But just remember that it's going to be one of those things where you need to, you know, check the temperature of yourself, read the room, and figure out, you know, whether you're doing this for the public or you're doing it because you have a really strong feeling about the matter. And you, in a lot of these cases, I'm sure you may well have a very strong feeling. Any conduct which hinders or prevents the agency from deciding a matter on the basis of own circumstances is prohibited. That's what I would say. Don't do your own research. Just go with what's in your packet. Trust your experts. Your experts, you know, they know what they're talking about. Board members should disqualify themselves if they entertain strong feelings about the specific facts of the case, which will influence their opinion regardless of the evidence. You know, that I tend to see that with, you know, any cases of sexual abuse of a child. For some board members, will have a very hard time with those cases. I would encourage you to hear those cases and participate, and that's part of your job. But I also understand that for some people, some facts of some cases will be triggering, or you know, it would be very hard for you to get through. So again, if you have an issue, just discuss it with Heather. If you'd like to discuss it with me, I'd be happy to discuss. Disqualification means that the board member will not participate. Easy thing to do is to recuse. Push yourself back from the table, go sit in the audience, use the restroom, get a snack. When a board member recuses, it's important to state on the record at the public meeting at the beginning of the case, just say, Mr. Chairman, I will not be participating in this case. And then again, it says best practice to leave the board table. You do not necessarily have to put on the record what your actual conflict is. You can simply state that, you know, you would just be recusing from this matter. Also, if there may come a time where you know somebody and you feel that, you know, while you can participate, you would like it to be clear to the for the record that you do know this person, and you know them in a professional, or you know them as a friend. But you feel that you can be unbiased in making the decision. That's 100% appropriate to put on the record. Some people do that every once in a while when they feel it may be obvious that they know somebody but want to make clear that they can hear the case. Again, following circumstances do not constitute an appearance of impropriety. Being acquainted with the individual, serving on committees with the individual, I think one of the biggest appearances of impropriety is when board members, and this board doesn't do it, so I applaud you, but it's when board members know somebody who has a complaint and they're not necessarily recusing because they're not biased and they don't have a conflict, but they will go and sit next to that individual and talk with them, chum it up with them before the meeting, and that could be right in front of the complainant. Now, if that's not the appearance of impropriety, I don't know what is. You know, the people before us who submit these complaints need to know that the board is here to make fair decisions to protect public health and safety, and that their own feelings about people aren't going to get involved. And talking, you know, chumming it up with the respondent before a meeting is definitely going to appear improper. And then ex parte communication is a big one. Oral written communication between the decision maker and one party to a proceeding. So let's say we're in a formal hearing. It would not be appropriate for
board members to email me about the case, I will be screened off to you. That would be an ex parte communication. Similarly, I would not be able to email board members to get their opinion on a case. That would be a violation. Similarly, the respondent or their attorney would be creating ex parte communication if they were to try to discuss a matter with you. Ex parte communications may indicate a bias or prejudgment that taints the decision-making process. In general, ex parte communications and administrative proceeding is communication between the decision-maker and one side of the dispute or third party in the absence of other party or parties, and may include communication about a board matter between a board member and a licensee, complainant or applicant, or other person that occurs outside the public board meeting without all parties present. So that's important. What I described to you the first time was ex parte communications in a formal hearing setting. Now, in a regular board setting, you can feel free to email Heather or I if you feel necessary to ask any questions to try to clarify anything. That's not ex parte communication. What would be ex parte communication would be discussing the case with the complainant or the respondent outside of a board meeting. And sometimes people will do that. I'm sure Dr. Campbell's had people email her or try to call her, hey, I have a complaint, Dr. Campbell, you know, I know you, can we talk about it? You know, the easiest thing to do is just say, sorry, I can't do it. I'm sorry, I can't do it. I need you to talk to Heather. Please go look at the board's website. You can reach out to Heather if you have an issue. And that's just the easiest way to nip it in the bud. Generally speaking, a board member may not initiate, permit, or consider communication made outside the presence of the parties regarding a pending or impending proceeding. The problem with ex parte communication that impugns the integrity of the decision-making process, can give the appearance of favoritism, deprive the absent party of the right to respond and be heard. It can be misleading because it exposes the decision-maker to one-sided arguments, which carry the attendant risk of an erroneous ruling on the law or fact. The board can act only through a majority of a board meeting. All board members should have the same information about a board matter. The reason for the strict rule against ex parte communication is that the opportunity for bias is minimized if all parties are present whenever any evidence or argument is being presented to the decision maker. So, again, in the case of a formal hearing, if I wanted to say something to the judge, if I wanted to file something with the board, then I would always include the respondent counsel so that they are part of the communication. So again, easiest thing for you to remember, don't talk to the respondent complaining about a case outside of a meeting, don't talk to board members about cases outside the meeting. You can talk to Heather or I, and then in a formal hearing, that's the difference. The difference is just don't ever include me on anything during a formal hearing. You'll have an independent advisor, and you can discuss anything you want with them as far as legalities. Ex parte communications may also violate the open meeting law. And we don't want to violate the open meeting law. That's the big scary one. And then just consequences, they can reverse our opinion. They can throw the case out, start it over. Can nullify board action, and again, can result in civil penalty, remove from office, and potentially other adjudications. So, and then I just gave you some definitions if you want to just look through those in your own time. Again, I'm always here to help, always here to give you advice on any kind of conflict of interest you have. So please just feel free to reach out. Thank you.
Thanks, Seamus. Thank you. All right. So that concludes all our education items, right, for the year?
Yes, I believe
yes.
So.
Yeah. Okay. Very good.
So we'll move on now to 10, which is Heather's Executive Director's Report.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, board members. I provided, just as a for your information, the annual notice of representation from the Attorney General's Office, a summary of the current budget, and a summary of the complaint log. No new complaints have been added since I sent board materials, and I can answer any questions on any of those items. And that's all I have.
Okay, so sounds like there were no questions for Heather, so we'll move on to 11, which is summary of current events. We have nothing under that topic. Call to the public is 12, and there is no public left. Then we have 13, which is discussion of possible action for items for future meeting agendas. And I have a few that I've asked Heather to include. A discussion on a presentation of discussion of the American Foot Care Nurses. I'm given the professional licensing lecture to the first year students at the Arizona School of Podiatric Medicine on April the 1st. We also need to discuss with and find a compatible time for Jay LeBeau from Federation of Podiatric Medical Boards to do a Zoom presentation of the compact, and including Mr. Abadi and the State Association Board. And then we need to discuss what action that we will take regarding Gateway Recovery Institute. Anybody else have anything at this time they'd like to add? And as always, if you come up with something you'd like on the agenda, please contact Heather. Our next meeting is April the 9th at 8 a.m. And is there anything else? Anybody have any final comments or questions before closing the meeting? Okay, so hearing no other things to discuss, we've completed all agenda items, and so I will make a motion to adjourn the meeting at 9:58 a.m.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Good day.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Everyone else has left the call.
Heather, I'm looking at the clock up there. It says 10:55, and I'm like, there's no way.